Chapter 12. 80 coffins required a lot of space. They were laid in perfect rows, all neatly wrapped in red, white, and blue, all the same length and width. They'd arrived 30 minutes earlier aboard an Air Force cargo plane and were removed with great pomp and ceremony. Almost 1,000 friends and relatives sat on folding chairs on the concrete floor of the hangar and stared in shock at the sea of flags arranged before them. They were outnumbered only by the shaggy dogs, all quarantined behind barricades and military police. Even for a country well accustomed to foreign policy boondoggles, it was an impressive body count. 80 Americans, 8 Brits, 8 Germans, no French because they'd been boycotting Western diplomatic functions in Cairo. Why were 80 Americans still in the embassy after 10 p.m.? That was the question of the hour. And so far, no good answer had surfaced. So many of those who made such decisions were now lying in their coffins. The best theory buzzing around D.C. was that the caterer had been late, and the band even later. But the terrorists had proved all too well that they would strike at any hour. So what difference did it make how late the ambassador and his wife and their staff and colleagues and guests wanted to party? The second great question of the hour was just exactly why did we have 80 people in our embassy in Cairo to begin with? The State Department had yet to acknowledge the question. After some mournful music from an Air Force band, the president spoke. His voice broke, and he managed to summon a tear or two, but after 8 years of such theatrics, the act had worn thin. He'd already promised revenge many times, so he dwelt on comfort and sacrifice, and the promise of a better life in the hereafter. The Secretary of State called the names of the dead, a morbid recitation designed to capture the gravity of the moment. The sobbing increased. Then some more music. The longest speech was delivered by the Vice President, fresh from the campaign trail and filled with newly discovered commitment to eradicate terrorism from the face of the earth. Though he'd never worn a military uniform, he seemed eager to start tossing grenades. Lake had them all on the run. Lake watched the grim ceremony while flying from Tucson to Detroit, late for another round of interviews. On board was his pollster, a newly acquired magician who now traveled with him. While Lake and his staff watched the news, the pollster worked feverishly at the small conference table upon which he had 2 laptops, 3 phones, and more printouts than any 10 people could digest. The Arizona and Michigan primaries were 3 days away, and Lake's numbers were climbing, especially in his home state, where he was in a dead heat with the long-established front-runner Governor Terry of Indiana. In Michigan, Lake was 10 points down, but people were listening. The fiasco in Cairo was working beautifully in his favor. Governor Terry was suddenly scrambling for money. Aaron Lake was not. It was coming in faster than he could spend it. When the vice president finally finished, Lake left the screen and returned to his leather swivel recliner and picked up a newspaper. A staff member brought him coffee, which he sipped while watching the flatlands of Kansas 8 miles below him. Another staff member handed him a message, one that was supposed to require an urgent call from the candidate. Lake glanced around the plane and counted 13 people, pilots not included. For a private man who still missed his wife, Lake was not adjusting well to the complete lack of privacy. He moved with a group, every half hour slotted by someone, every action coordinated by a committee, every interview preceded by written guesses about the questions and suggested responses. He got 6 hours each night alone in his hotel room and damned if the Secret Service wouldn't sleep on the floor if he'd allow it. Because of the fatigue, he slept like an infant. His only true moments of quiet reflection occurred in the bathroom, either in the shower or on the toilet. But he wasn't kidding himself. He, Aaron Lake, quiet congressman from Arizona, had become an overnight sensation. He was charging while the rest were faltering. Big money was aimed at him. The press followed like bloodhounds. His words got repeated. He had very powerful friends, and as the pieces were falling in place, the nomination looked realistic. He hadn't dreamed of such things a month earlier.